these distribution chains are interrupted, and it's been really cool to see local organizing.
Yes, Lisa. Is the water warm enough? Yes, Lisa. Shall we begin?
It's WGXC 90.7 FM.
Right.
Accra.
Keep going.
Hudson, Catskill, Phoenicia, and lots of other places.
That's an interesting addition.
And Valencia.
And
or
Valencia.
As they usually call it when you first land in Columbia County.
Valati.
Valati.
Very well done. Did you mention the online way
and to online use? At WGXC.org.
Yes.
Hay acciones cotidianas para ayudar a prevenir la propagación de enfermedades respiratorias. Lávese las manos. Evite el contacto cercano con las personas enfermas. Evite tocarse los ojos, la nariz y la boca. Quédese en casa cuando esté enfermo. Cúbrase al toser o estornudar. Limpie y desinfecte de manera frecuente los objetos que toca. Para obtener más información, visite cdc.gov/COVID-19. Este mensaje es gentileza de la National Association of Broadcasters y de esta estación.
WGXE underwriting support is provided by Hilo Catskill, cafe, bar, art gallery, and performance space located at 365 Main Street, Catskill, New York. Waveform's WGXE is pleased to broadcast live from Hilo every Tuesday morning starting at 9 a.m. In addition, Hilo live events are streamed and broadcast in conjunction with the Waveform Radio Transmit Partner Program.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Hello and welcome to a myriad of musings and music with the ninth grade at BCD.
Hello, everybody. We are here today interviewing Sam Fleming, the executive director and one of the founders of the 100 Gardens Project. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Good. How are you doing?
So our first question is, can you tell us a little bit about, what 100 Gardens does? And more specifically, what is an aquaponics lab?
Sure. So I guess let me start with the why, and then that will kind of branch into the what and then the how. So really we're facing sort of a really challenging time going into the next 30 years and beyond. The year 2050 is going to be a year that right now is predicted to be when we reach what may be a complete collapse of most of our major seafood species, meaning we're not going to have many fish left in about 30 years. And also at that time, we'll have less fresh water, and there'll be about 10 billion to 10.5 billion human beings on the planet. So what does that, you know, world look like when we have less food, less water, and more people?
Yeah.
So luckily, though, you know, we can come up with solutions. So enter aquaponics. So aquaponics is a method of farming where you grow edible freshwater fish like tilapia or catfish or hybrid striped bass or carp, and you grow them in big tanks, and then you use the water coming out of those tanks, which is filled with dissolved nutrients created by the fish through their waste. Mm-hmm. And those nutrients are used to fertilize vegetables that are growing without soil, and those vegetables use up those nutrients in the water in order to grow, returning clean water back to the fish. So this helps to address our issue of the collapsed oceans, because we can grow fish on land and take pressure off our wild species. We can recirculate the water over and over again, which conserves our precious freshwater resources. And then we can grow a lot of vegetables to feed an increasing population. So that's really what aquaponics is, and that's why it's relevant right now in terms of where we are as human beings and how we exist here on the planet. So 100 Gardens is an educational nonprofit organization, and we go into schools and institutions such as the Berkshire County Sheriff's Department and House of Corrections, and we implement aquaponics training programs where we teach people how to become aquaponics farmers, but more important, what you learn through learning aquaponics is how to better take care of your environment, because the discipline that's required to maintain an aquaponics system, which is really a living ecosystem, that discipline really shows you how to better interact with our planet, and it shows you how to create healthy food while using the least amount of resources. So that's what we do. And we found that over the years, in addition to all the things I've just mentioned, aquaponics is really also a great platform for learning science and math and all sorts of STEM-related subjects.
Great. So could you just tell us a little bit how you got originally started with aquaponics?
Sure. So I used to be more of a hydroponics hobbyist, which is growing plants without soil using chemical fertilizers. I started doing that when I was 17 or 18 years old. And then I got a job at a local hydroponics retail shop when I was 19, and then was managing the whole place when I was 21. And so I had started to sort of get a name for myself out in that world. And then an architect came into my store, and this was about 2011 maybe, and he told me he had just got back from Haiti, and Haiti is a country in the Caribbean. And a year prior to that, they had gotten hit with the worst earthquake in terms of human catastrophe, probably in the history of the world almost. Nearly 200,000 people died in about 2 weeks. And it just devastated the whole country. And so Ron Morgan, who was this architect who came into my store, had this idea about building hydroponic gardens in Haiti and teaching farmers a new way of farming. Because if you look at the history of Haiti, it's 300 plus, almost 400 plus years of slavery before they gained their independence. And then all of that, and then the deforestation that happened, they lost all of the topsoil on the whole island. So basically they have no or very little adequate farmland to grow their own food. So Ron had this idea of, well, what if we set up these decentralized hydroponics training facilities and started teaching farmers how to grow food hydroponically, and they could build their economy from the ground up. And him not being a farmer, Googled hydroponics and then found my store and just came in there while I happened to be working, and he told me what he was trying to do. So I thought it was really interesting, and I told him about aquaponics, which is integrating the fish into it, and I had just, it was kind of weird, like 6 months later, I had just set up like an aquaponics system, the first one built in Charlotte. Uh-huh. No one was doing it. I found some information on the internet, and I built one, and I showed it to him, and he flipped out and was like, this is awesome. So we became really good friends. I was like 23 at the time, and he was 68 years old. But we became like really close, and then started 100 Gardens as really a humanitarian effort to try and take this technology down to Haiti. And when we did that, the first thing we had to do was to build one that was like real and to show people that it worked before we took it down there. So we built one in his yard, and before we knew it, all the neighbors were talking about it. And then we had the kids of the neighbors showing up wanting to help us take care of the fish. And then before we knew it, we were teaching aquaponics to 10, 11-year-olds. And they were learning science and math, and their parents would come back and tell us that, I don't know what you guys are doing, but you know, all of a sudden my kid's talking about science, and then that's kind of weird. So what are you guys up to? So that's when we kind of had this epiphany that not only was this a really great method for growing food and protecting the environment, but it was also sort of a way that we could engage young people in learning that was a lot more fun than opening up a textbook. And it was real, and it interfaced with the solutions of the future. So at that point, we realized we're going to start doing this in schools. And we started writing lesson plans and curriculum. And fast forward 7 years, we have programs in 11 schools and two correctional facilities. And it's so far been really exciting. So I'm just happy it all worked out.
So what is, I guess, the current state of the programs, like in general? I don't know, like across the U.S., how many are there? You've said you started in Charlotte and you have some at correctional facilities. How many really do you have so far?
So we have 10 schools that currently have an aquaponics system and are and have programming based around it. Those are mostly in North Carolina. Actually, all of them are in North Carolina.
Okay.
And then we have a juvenile correctional facility, which is incarcerated teenagers in North Carolina. That's like our biggest program here. And then we have the greenhouse that you guys toured up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And that's our 12th program that we have. So we're in 10 schools and two correctional facilities. And basically, we have a pretty much a standard set of services. So we come in and we build the facility, and then we train the staff or teachers on how to run it and then on how to utilize the curriculum materials for their classes. And then we set up a partnership agreement with each one of the schools, and you know, they have a certain amount of funding that they have to get in order to pay us, and then we bring resources to the table also, so we work in partnership. And then we provide tech support, so we show up once every 2 weeks, make sure all the systems are working, greenhouse components are working, aquaponics systems are in balance. And so we provide technical support every year, and then we help the teachers with some of the more intimidating lesson plans. So like with the math lessons where we're tracking fish growth and pulling fish out of the tanks, we show up and we help the math teachers do that. So we provide the building, the professional development for staff and teachers. We write curriculum materials, and we provide technical support to the whole process. We just try and make it better every year and establish long-term relationships with each of our school partners. We're not in the business of building systems and leaving. We're in the business of making your learning more engaging and, you know, more real through aquaponics. And so we want to make friends for the long term so we can keep making it better.
So how do you plan to expand the program in the future? How do you plan to reach more people and more different areas with new facilities and things like that?
Right. So right now we are expanding into 3 more schools in 2020. And the real goal for expansion is to find schools that really want to do something different and want to bring a real hands-on approach to learning and that care about environment and healthy food. So those are really some of the main things that have to be required for us to want to work with a school. But sort of our plan for expansion is we are standardizing like a large greenhouse model that high schools can use. And when we set up our high school systems, they actually partner with a restaurant and they sell all the crops to a restaurant. So they're basically running a business, and that actually funds our entire involvement. Most schools can pay all of our partnership costs just through selling to a restaurant, and then they raise additional money to be used however they want it above that. So we're creating a standard model for high schools, and then we have a indoor aquaponics system that's used for middle and elementary schools, or it could be a high school. It's smaller, but it is able to ship out on a pallet It would come complete with a curriculum package, and then we would provide technical support through video conferencing and email and all that. And when we release that, which we expect to do later in 2020, we think that we can ship those all around the country and get people engaged in this kind of learning. And then we'll build the bigger facilities as they come up. Those will kind of be more, you know, I don't see those being as frequent. Maybe two, we might get build two or three a year, but I could see us shipping out 20 to 30 of these indoor units a year once we really get the ball rolling with them. So that's kind of how we intend to expand, is to just find more quality school partners and then create a system that can be scaled out on a smaller scale and be used all around the country. And then that would require additional staff and me stepping more into a management role as opposed to what I do now, which is partly a management role, but also teaching and also building. We have three staff members and we kind of do it all. So, but eventually you have to, once you get so big, you have to step into more of a management role and teach other people to do what you're doing right now. So that'll all be a part of the expansion. Was that kind of what you were looking for?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the different programs in schools in North Carolina and then the facility which we visited. So when, for example, a student goes through the program, what do you hope they take out of it? Some sort of skill, or what do you hope they learn from the program?
Sure. So the main thing is when you go through like an aquaponics program, you really have to have like a course developed around it. So most of our schools actually have an aquaponics kind of like a class. What our outcomes are is that, one, you learn all the skills related to aquaponics. So you understand water chemistry, mm-hmm. basics in like fish biology, plant biology. But also you learn how to essentially be an entrepreneur. So you have to do daily tasks every day that are required. You have to harvest so many crops every week that are sold to a restaurant. You have to manage the sales. You have to write the invoices. So you really learn. We want people to learn how to participate in our economy when they get out of school, but also develop all the great skills that could be transferred to a lot of different career opportunities, and then feel like they are making a difference in terms of our environmental sustainability, and feel like they are inspired to come up with more solutions for how we face all these challenges that are right or like, you know, 30 years ahead of us. We're living in it right now. So the main outcomes we want is for people to change the way that they're currently thinking about their future pursuits and how they exist here on Earth. We want people to change the way that they think from in a holistic way.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, so far as this program has developed, have you seen any examples of people who've really been changed by this aquaponics program, or they've learned new skills and they've planned to use them?
Yeah, for sure. We've had a lot of students at Stonewall Jackson Youth Development Center, which is our where the incarcerated teenagers are. They're very involved with the program. You know, they do it for 2 hours a day. They have a class. And we've had several of them land jobs afterwards just because they became interested in an assortment of different careers. So mm-hmm. when you run an aquaponics system, you have to learn some basics of plumbing. Yep. And so we've had students who said, man, I know how to do plumbing. I'd be into that. Had students that want to get into landscaping, students want to get into vegetable production. Mm-hmm. But one student in particular, he was one of our best ones, and he was actually was considered here in North Carolina, it's called OCS. And OCS is basically when the school system says that you don't have enough intellectual capacity to make it through high school, so they put you in an OCS class, which means occupational course of study. And he was thrown into those classes early on before he was incarcerated, and just kind of thought he was, you know, quote unquote, one of the special kids. And so he came into our program and he really did well. And before you knew it, he was doing all the math, he was doing all the water chemistry, and he really figured it out. Wow. And then he got his GED. I mean, within 2 years of coming to the aquaponics program, he went from OCS kid to passing his GED test, because he gave him the self-confidence to pursue education. He just never knew he was smart. And then beyond that, we had him host a tour when the Department of Public Safety leadership, which is, so if you're in an incarceration facility, the North Carolina Department of Public Safety is who oversees all that. And they sent some people down to check out the program, and he gave them a tour. And they asked them, you know, so you've learned all these great skills, you know, what do you want to do with your life when you get out of here? And out of nowhere, he just says, well, I want to open up a motorcycle shop. Oh. And they are all like, well, what does that have to do with anything? And he was like, well, you know, I know how to fix water pumps and do plumbing and all this stuff now, but I'm not that interested in growing plants for a living. But I'm pretty sure I could fix a motorcycle now, and I am interested in that. So it was really an unintended consequence of just providing this kind of hands-on learning and inspiring people to be better than who they thought they could be. So that's an example I like to tell people.
Yeah. Cool. So we recently visited the Berkshire County Jail. Could you just tell us a little bit about how the aquaponics was introduced to the correctional system?
And this jail specifically?
Yeah.
So that's one of the more wild stories of my life. I was heading up to Hartford, Connecticut about 5 years ago, at least. Probably 5 years ago. To an hydroponics conference in Hartford, Connecticut. And I get on the plane, and the guy I'm sitting beside is an older guy, and he's wearing a Florida State t-shirt, and I like college football. So we started talking about football, and he's asked me, you know, what do you do for a living? So I tell him about this program I'm running at the juvenile corrections facility in North Carolina, and I show him all these pictures of the aquaponics greenhouse and the kids being engaged, and he's like really impressed. And then he introduces himself as the sheriff superintendent for Berkshire County House of Corrections. And so it was just this really weird situation. And so then he gives me his contact information, but we trade cards. And about 6 months later, I get a call from Jack Quinn, who was the guy on the plane. And he says, hey, Sam, you remember me from the plane? And he said, I've been talking to the sheriff about this, and I think it's something we want to do. So can I fly your team up here to check out our facility and to take the next step? So he flew me and my business partner, Monty, up to Pittsfield, and we did a site plan. And then he said, okay, well, let's put together a budget. And we were just planning on building like a small one, like, you know, maybe 1/4 of the size of the one we built. And then Robin McGraw, who you met, they put him on the project, and they said, Robin, make this happen. And so Robin kind of talked to me and said, well, you know, how big should we do this? And I always think, you know, if we make it a little bit bigger, it will be taken more seriously. It'll be real. And so let's make it real. So Robin made it really real, like really, really real. So he went out and raised about $500,000, and did almost all the groundwork. We did the design work, but Robin really did almost every single thing you could do. He did the project management, the procurement, the fundraising, the relationship building, working with contractors, building the greenhouse. He did all that. And it took about a year and a half, 2 years for him to raise the money and build the greenhouse. And then he called us up and hired us to come in and build all the systems on the inside. And so we finished up about December when we were done, completely done with construction. And then so now we're running. They got plants in there now. So they'll have their first harvest in about 3.5 weeks.
Wow. So what are some of the challenges that you've run into in running this organization?
Could you say that again? I didn't hear you that clearly.
What are some of the challenges that you've run into running a program like this?
So the biggest challenges that we first ran into when we were first getting started was that we didn't really have any course materials written, and I'm not a formal educator. You know, I didn't even go to college, so I just came out of high school and started working. So when we first started doing this, we got a contract so fast with the Department of Public Safety in North Carolina that we were building an aquaponics program and had zero curriculum materials at all. And we were just going in there and teaching these guys how to do it. It was very, like, visceral, and it was great. But we didn't have any materials, so we couldn't really implement these, like, replicate that program. So the first challenge was that we had to start writing materials, curriculum materials, and none of us are formal educators. So we just pretty much had to try and teach ourselves how to do that. So we started writing curriculum materials. The schools or the places that we build these that are that we have the best programs at are really the correctional facilities and non-traditional schools, like trade schools, vocational schools. We even have a program in a special needs school and with a school for the blind in North Carolina. Yeah. And those programs tend to be our strongest programs because they're not constricted by the rigors of the school day. So we can actually create a program that's really focused around this. The biggest challenges we have right now is working with traditional public schools because basically we'll come into a school and they'll want our program, but it's really hard to get teachers to come out of their current curriculum, which they're judged on the test scores of their students. So they really have to teach everything.
Yeah.
And it intimidates them to get out of their normal routines with teaching their standards and go into a greenhouse and do like real hands-on activities. That's been one of our big challenges right now is figuring out how to best work with public schools and get the outcomes that we want, because public schools, until we can create an elective course that's completely aquaponics in a school, then it's going to be hard for us to have the impact we want, because the structure of public schools is not based around programs like we have. So that's right now probably the most challenging thing is figuring out how to increase our impact within traditional public schools that have restraints and bureaucracy on every corner.
Mm-hmm. So how can we as individual people or as a community help to support your aquaponics programs in general?
Right. So the main thing that I try and tell people, so there's a couple different ways to do it, but since you guys aren't here, volunteering isn't going to be very likely unless you volunteer up at Pittsfield. But the main thing is I really want people to try and connect us with like-minded concerned citizens who would put us in touch with schools that we could partner with. As a nonprofit, most nonprofits are just going to straight up ask you for money, and that's fine because they need it and they're doing nonprofit work and it doesn't pay the same way for-profit work does. So, but we always, asking for money is about the last thing we do. What we want to do is take on more work and take on more projects. So if anyone's listening, you know, you can really help us by connecting us with potential school partners that we can build more aquaponics systems at. If you do want to just donate and put us in your giving budget, you can go to 100gardens.org and click on the donate tab, and you can make a financial contribution. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit, so it is tax deductible. Mm-hmm. And then if you're in the North Carolina area or you're near Pittsfield, Massachusetts, there are ways that you can volunteer and mentor students or mentor inmates. There's a lot of needs out there, but that's what I would suggest is either connect us with more potential clients or make a financial contribution or try and give your time, energy, and talent to helping out one of our programs.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being on our show today. I think we're going to have to wrap it up now, but thank you so much for letting us interview you. Yeah.
Oh, not a problem. I appreciate the work you guys are doing, and I hope to see you again soon once I'm back up in Pittsfield.
Yep. So this was a call-in. You were calling in. This one of the first ones we've had. So thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. You got it.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
So we are now going to be transitioning to our music segment, in which we're going to be playing exclusively Johnny Cash, because our interview was took place at a jail, and Johnny Cash is well known for his activism for inmates and his songs about jail. And so we're going to start off with one of his most iconic ones, Folsom Prison Blues. This one is going to be performed live at Folsom Prison. And this song was actually not written by Johnny Cash exclusively, but it was written by the Highwaymen, which was the band that Johnny Cash was a part of. So here is Folsom Prison Blues, live.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. Dining car, they're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming, I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me.
Johnny Cash song is a fun song that we all enjoyed. This song was also not written by Johnny Cash exclusively. It was actually written by someone named Jack Clement. And here is the one on the right is on the left.
There once was a musical troupe, a picking, singing folk group. They sang the mountain ballads and the folk songs of our land. They were long on musical ability, folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
this musical aggregation toured the entire nation, singing traditional ballads and the folk songs of our land. They performed with great virtuosity, and soon they were the rage, but political animosity prevailed upon the stage. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear burned his driver's license. Well, the curtain had ascended, a hush fell on the crowd as thousands there were gathered to hear the folk songs of our land. But they took their politics seriously, and that night at the concert hall, as the audience watched deliriously, they had a free-for-all. Well, the one on the right was on the bottom, and the one in the middle was on the top, and the one on the left got a broken arm, and the guy on his rear said, "Oh dear." Now this should be a lesson. If you plan to start a folk group, don't go mixing politics with the folk songs of our land. Just work on harmony and diction, play your banjo well, and if you have political conviction, keep them to yourself. Now the one on the left works in a bank, and the one in the middle drives a truck. The one on the right's an all-night DJ, and the guy in the rear got drafted.
Years ago, on a cold, dark night, someone was killed neath the town hall lights. There were few at the scene, but they all agreed that the slayer who ran looked a lot like me. Now she walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. The scaffold was high and eternity near. She stood in a crowd and shed not a tear. But sometimes at night, when the cold wind moans in a long black veil, she cries o'er my bones. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. The judge said, "Son, what is your alibi? If you were somewhere else, then you won't have to die." I spoke not a word, though it meant my life. I'd been in the arms of my best friend's wife. She walks these hills in a long black veil. She visits my grave when the night winds wail. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. Nobody knows, nobody sees, nobody knows but me. Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'd know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, 'cause I'll have the only one there is around. So the very next day when I punched in with my big lunchbox and with help from my friend, I left that day with a lunchbox full of gears. I've never considered myself a thief, but GM wouldn't miss just one little piece, especially if I strung it out over several years. The first day I got me a fuel pump, and the next day I got me an engine and a trunk, then I got me a transmission and all the chrome. The little things I could get in my big lunchbox, like nuts and bolts and all four shocks, but the big stuff we snuck out my buddy's mobile home. Now up to now my plan went all right, till we tried to put it all together one night, and that's when we noticed that something was definitely wrong. The transmission was a 53 and the motor turned out to be a 73, and when we tried to put in the bolts all the holes were gone. So we drilled it out so that it would fit, and with a little bit of help from an adapter kit, we had that engine running just like a song. Now the headlights, there was another sight. We had two on the left and one on the right, but when we pulled out the switch, all three of them come on. The back end looked kind of funny too, but we put it together, and when we got through, well, that's when we noticed that we only had one tail fin. About that time my wife walked out, and I could see in her eyes that she had her doubts. But she opened the door and said, "Honey, take me for a spin." So we drove uptown just to get the tags, and I headed to ride on down Main Drag. I could hear everybody laughing for blocks around, but up there at the courthouse they didn't laugh, 'cause to type it up it took the whole staff, and when they got through the title weighed 60 pounds. I got it one piece at a time, and it didn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, 'cause I'll have the only one there is around. Yeah, Red Rider, this is the Cottonmouth in the Psycho Billy Cadillac, come on. Paul. This is a Cottonmouth, and negatory on the cost of this machine there, Red Rider. You might say I went right up to the factory and picked it up. It's cheaper that way. What model is it? Well, it's a 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59 automobile. It's a 60, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, 69.
The old hometown looks the same as I step down from the train, and there to meet me is my mama and my papa. Down the road I look, and there runs Mary, hair of golden, lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. The old house is still standing,
though the paint is cracked and dry. And there's that old oak tree that I used to play on. Down the lane I walk with my sweet Mary, hair of golden, lips like cherries. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. Yes, they'll all come to see me, arms reaching, smiling sweetly. It's good to touch the green, green grass of home. Then I'll awake and look around me to the cold gray walls that surround me. And then I realize I was only dreaming. For there's a guard and the saddle. Touch the green, green grass of home. Yes, they'll all come to see me in the shade of the old oak tree as they lay me neath the green, green grass of home.
Thank you very much. This next song was written by a man right here in Folsom Prison. And last night was the first time I've ever sung this song. Anyway, this song was written by our friend Glenn Shirley. And hope we do your song justice, Glenn. We're going to do our best.
In a little cabaret in a South Texas border town sat a boy and his guitar, and the people came from all around, and all the girls from there to Austin were slipping away from home and putting jewelry in pocket to take the trip to go and listen to the little dark-haired boy that played the Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play. Couldn't write or wrangle, and he never cared to make a dime, but give him his guitar and he'd be happy all the time. And all the girls from 9 to 90 were snapping fingers, tapping toes, and begging him don't stop, and hypnotized and fascinated by the little dark-haired boy that played the Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play. Then one day he was gone, and no one ever saw him round. He vanished like the breeze, and they forgot him in the little town. But all the girls still dreamed about him and hung around the cabaret until the doors were locked. And then one day on the hit parade was a little dark-haired boy that played a Tennessee flat-top box, and he would play.
My name is Joe Roberts. I work for the state. I'm a sergeant out in Perrinville, barracks number 8. I've always done an honest job, honest as I could. Got a brother named Frankie. Frankie ain't no good. Well, ever since we were young kids, it's been the same come down. I'd get a call on the short way. Frankie's in trouble downtown. Well, if it was any other man, I'd put him straight away. But sometimes when it's your brother, you look the other way. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch him when he's straying, like any brother should. Man turns his back on his family. He ain't no good. Well, Frankie went into the army back in 1965. I got a farm deferment, settled down, took Maria for my wife. But them wheat prices kept on dropping till it was like we's getting robbed. Frankie came home in 68. Me, I took this job. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch you when he's straying. Teach him how to walk that line. Man turns his back on his family. Ain't no friend of mine. The night was like any other. I got a call about 8:45. There was trouble at a roadhouse out on the Michigan line. There was a kid on the floor looking bad, bleeding hard from his head. There was a girl crying at a table. It was Frankie, she said. I ran out and I jumped in my car. Then I hit the lights. I must have done about 110 through Michigan County that night. It was down by the crossroads, out by Willow Bank. Seen a Buick with Ohio plates behind wheel. Well, I chased him through them county roads till a sign said Canadian border 5 miles from here. Pulled over to the side of the highway, watched the taillights disappear. Yeah, me and Frankie laughing and drinking. Nothing feels better than blood on blood. Taking turns dancing with Maria while the band played the night of the Johnstown flood. I catch him when he's straying, like any brother should. Man turns his back on his family. He ain't no good.
my daddy left home when I was three, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him cause he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue. Well, I grew up quick and I grew up mean. My fists got hard, my wits got keen. Roamed from town to town to hide my shame. But I made me a vow to the moon and stars, I'd search the honky-tonks and bars and kill that man that gave me that awful name. Well, it was Gatlinburg in mid-July, and I'd just hit town and my throat was dry. I thought I'd stop and have myself a brew. At an old saloon on a street of mud, there at a table, dealing stud, sat a dirty mangy dog that named me Sue. Well, I knew that snake was my own sweet dad from a worn-out picture that my mother'd had. And I knew that scar on his cheek and his evil eye. He was big and bent and gray and old, and I looked at him and my blood ran cold. And I said, my name is Sue. How do you do? How are you gonna die? Yeah, that's what I told him. Well, I hit him hard right between the eyes, and he went down, but to my surprise, come up with a knife and cut off a piece of my ear. But I busted a chair right across his teeth, and we crashed through the wall and into the street, kicking and a gouging in the mud and the blood and the beard. I tell you, I've fought tougher men, but I really can't remember when. He kicked like a mule and he bit like a crocodile. I heard him laugh and then I heard him cuss, and he went for his gun and I pulled mine first. He stood there looking at me and I saw him smile. He said, son, this world is rough, and if a man's gonna make it, he's gotta be tough. And I know I wouldn't be there to help you along. So I give you that name and I said goodbye. I knew you'd have to get tough or die. And it's that name that helped to make you strong. Yeah. He said, now you just fought one hell of a fight, and I know you hate me and you got the right to kill me now, and I wouldn't blame you if you do. But you ought to thank me before I die for the gravel in your guts and the spit in the eye, cause I'm the that named you Sue. Yeah, what could I do? What could I do? I got all choked up and I threw down my gun, called him a paw and he called me a son, and I come away with a different point of view. And I think about him now and then, every time I try and every time I win. And if I ever have a son, I think I'm gonna name him Bill or George, anything but Sue. I still ain't been there. I remember when I was a lad, times were hard and things were bad, but there's a silver lining behind every cloud. Just poor people, that's all we were, trying to make a living out of black land dirt. But we'd get together in a family circle singing loud. Daddy sang bass, singing seems to help a troubled soul. One of these days, and it won't be long, I'll rejoin them in a song.